And welcome to Play Comics, where once again, we are just skipping over the whole video game thing, and I'm talking to another comic creator. This time, we're making it a rather Chris-ful episode, because I'm talking to Chris Sotomayor. Chris, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Chris. How are you doing?
Pretty good. We have to start this off with me admitting that I did something very bad. I'm holding this up so Chris can see it. Nobody else can, but it is the DC Love is a Battlefield issue.
Oh,
it is now in my house. I didn't realize you had anything in this because I wasn't looking. And right. Of course, it's today when it came out, when we were recording, and I did not read it.
It's okay.
In my defense,
we all have a stack.
I know, right? Mine is, how high is this? Really high. But in my defense, I got home and my wife had dinner ready.
Oh, okay. That's good.
I like to not get food all over my books.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't blame you.
But one thing that I'm really excited about talking to you about, which has almost nothing to do with that little bit of conversation at all, is I like to get into the minds of these creators because I have this vague idea that I want to create something. And so
okay.
I'm just wondering, what got you into working on comics in the first place?
Oh, I gotta say it's between... Like, my parents would always buy me Marvel comics or pretty much anything, you know, whenever we took a ride on the subway. I'm from New York, right? So take the subway everywhere. So they'd buy me like a Marvel 2-in-1 or something, or a Marvel team up, or an X-Men, you know, for the subway ride. So I got to say it's between that and watching reruns of the old Batman show.
The 66 one?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
The Adam West, Burt Ward. Yeah.
That is a really good
love
one,
that
though.
Show. Yeah. Yeah, that really kicked it off for me. And, you know, that was my love of superheroes. And my love of comics was, like I said, subway stuff, just to pass the time. And my uncle had a collection of, like, some oddly sized, novel-sized trade paperbacks, like, different collections. He loved Teen Titans for some reason, so I got into Teen Titans from reading some of his stuff. But yeah, that was my early exposure to comics and superheroes.
And primarily I'm seeing you credited as a colorist right now.
Right.
Me, I have no idea what that entails exactly.
Okay.
Besides having more art skills than I have.
Okay. Well, what that means is I get copies of the black and white artwork, and I have to paint it digitally. Most comics are done digitally now, so I get to finish the artwork. I'm the last person in line that gets to touch the artwork and have a hand in what that looks like. I usually work in conjunction with the letterer, so we're working, you know, in tandem. But yeah, I get the inks, I paint it, you know, and I use all the stuff I learned in art school to do that, and all the stuff I got to do growing up. And I interned in an artist studio for a while, and that helped too. But you know, it's more than just fill in the spaces. It's, you know, you got to think about mood and storytelling. It's an extension of whatever the penciler and the inker have done.
I realize this may be a really dumb question, but why do they get somebody else to do the colors? Is it like a spreading the workload issue kind of thing?
Yeah, it's for the most part trying to keep up with deadlines with periodicals. It gets to be, you know, it gets to be a thing where you have to divide up the labor and the assembly line. You know, sometimes you'll have an artist who can do everything, like Pete Woods. He's fantastic. He draws, he inks, he colors all on his iPad for the most part, as far as I know. He's brilliant. You have other guys like, well, Pete does storytelling pages. You have cover artists like Mark Brooks and Adi Granov, and they do all their own stuff too, and that stuff's fantastic. There are a bunch of guys who can who do it all themselves. Amy Reeder, she does a lot of it herself too. Yeah, but in terms of just being able to maintain deadlines and make sure books come out when they're supposed to come out, and you have as many books come out a year as you're supposed to get out, yeah, they divide up the workflow, which is fortunate for me, because I probably couldn't do the penciler's job as well as they do it. And I am not that great at inking anymore. Not that I was ever like, you know, Joe Rubenstein or Tom Ballmer or anything, but, you know, I did learn to ink. I did learn to, you know, draw and stuff in art school and growing up, and that all helps me to do the job I do. But it just makes it easier for everyone if they divide the workload up.
How much direction are you given versus being able to give something your own vision?
It depends on the creative team that I'm working with. Sometimes I'll go into a book and I'll work up a couple of pages to see if I've hit more or less what everyone's hoping I'll do or what people are thinking. Usually everyone's pretty nice about letting me go in first and figure out what I want to do or what my ideas are. And then they'll come back and they'll be like, hey, can you tweak stuff like this, or, you know, add a little of this, and that's all fine. Sometimes I'm just let go. Like, I'm working on a book with Joe Mulvey called Happy Hill. It's an indie book, and Joe just lets me do what I want to do. And we kind of lean on each other a bit with something like that. And I'll go in and I'll try to accent stuff he's really good at, or make sure I hit the right things. And if something doesn't quite look quite right, you know, I'll send him a text or something and say, hey, you know, what do you want me to do with this? Or I'll take the focus away from something like that. I wrapped up the question with Dennis Cowan and Bill Sienkiewicz. That was like a dream come true, that project, because I went in and I just did, you know, what I felt I wanted to do for that book. And Bill and Dennis especially, they seem to love it. And I'm fortunate enough to continue working with both of them.
What is it that drew you to colors like this?
Well, like I said, I interned in an artist studio for a while, and I learned the art of the business. I learned all the stuff that you need to be able to do to produce a comic. You know, in this studio, I drew backgrounds. I inked pages, sometimes whole figures, sometimes backgrounds and figures, sometimes just spotting blacks or ruling out pages. And I also got to color. I kind of learned after a while, you know, that was probably where I'm stronger, and just tried to develop that skill set a little more than the others. I still draw and stuff, and I paint physically, but coloring and digital coloring in particular, that's something I was drawn to, because there are a lot of possibilities to build on top of what's already come down in the artwork. And I kind of like that aspect of it.
Have you always been digital like this?
I got my start at Marvel in the 90s, in the mid and late 90s, like 96. And I started out doing color guides on two books for them, Journey into Mystery and Deadpool. And those were they'd send me photocopies of the artwork, and I would go in with markers and colored pencil and watercolors and gouache, and I would paint all the pages by hand, and then mark up codes and stuff on the side in the margins, you know, if there were specific colors that needed to be used for like a knockout or something, where you change the the artwork, the line art to a color or an effect, and I'd send that off. So I got started doing hand painted guides, and but I already knew how to work digitally also at that time. So I sharpened my skills doing color guides, and then branched out later on doing full digital colors on Captain America with Mark Waid and Andy Kubert and Tim Townsend. I mean, Jesse Delperdang. Yeah. And that was a lot of fun because, again, they just kind of let me do what I wanted to do. And that was at a time when there weren't a whole lot of digital colors at Marvel. It was probably Liquid, Paul Mounts, Digital Chameleon, and me. So, yeah, so they just kind of let me do what I wanted to do on that book. And then it just kind of snowballed from there.
And what would you say has been your personal style?
I kind of work in a few different styles, like in that that Love is a Battlefield book. You know, I did more of a cut and grad style. On The Question, it was very painterly, a lot of painting effects. And on Deadpool, it was kind of a hybrid of those styles. I don't know. I'm very comfortable kind of adapting my style to the artwork that I'm working on. But I really liked working on books like The Question or anything with Dennis Cowan. Anytime I get to work with Dennis, just puts me in a better mood. And I was working on his stuff today for a book, and there's just a lot of freedom and energy, and I like that kind of thing where I can just go in and just kind of let loose. It's nicer than like cut and grad is great, and it looks good on a lot of different projects. But it, to me, it feels a little constrained because I don't know. I don't want to say there's a lack of energy. Maybe there's a lack of spontaneity, I guess. But that's just for me personally, the way I handle it. I know there are a bunch of colorists who use different styles, and they just look amazing. Edgar Delgado and Marte Gracia both use a cut and grad style or cut and brush style, and they're just fantastic.
One of the things I've noticed looking through here is that, you know, writers and artists tend to stay the same, but I see the color switching around a lot. Is there a reason for that?
We tend to work on multiple projects at a time. Like right now I'm working on probably like 4 or 5 books at the same time. So you'll see us around more. Sometimes editors like to mix and match colorists with different pencilers, with different artists. Sometimes artists will opt for another colorist who they haven't worked with before, or just haven't gotten a chance to work with before, or they think they'll be more appropriate given their style on a certain book. You know, Jordy Belair is amazing on Batman. I love that limited palette type style for that. You know, and Marta Gracia is great on X-Men. You know, it's pure superheroes. And I mean, I could look at his stuff all day. You know, then you got guys like Richard Isenov and Dean White, and they do just completely different things with different styles, and they have artists that they like to work with, which is awesome. We all have artists that we like to work with, but I mean, in general, we kind of, because we have the ability to work on multiple projects at a time, you know, just, you'll see us move around a lot. Like I tend to move around a lot. It also keeps it interesting for me, at least.
Usually I ask this question just kind of as a level checking audio thing beforehand, but I can finally ask it in an appropriate way. What is your third favorite color?
My third favorite color? I probably red.
Usually favorite, I just get confused answers, which is fine because all I'm doing is checking audio levels. But I'm glad that at least once I can ask that for real and have it be relevant.
Okay. Usually people ask me like my favorite color or whatever, which tends to shift sometimes depending. But yeah, red is usually pretty solid, my third.
That's specifically why I went for third, because usually first and second are, I mean, they might flip back and forth with people. but nobody ever thinks about third.
Right.
So what's a project or a character that you really want to work on that you haven't had a chance to do yet?
Oh, I would love to take a run on Daredevil or even Moon Knight. I would say Daredevil, Moon Knight, Ghost Rider. I've not worked on runs for those characters. I've done a couple of things here and there. You know, with Daredevil, I've done like a one shot. I've done a couple of one shots, or in a backup story. Moon Knight, I don't think I've done any Moon Knight except for some covers. And Ghost Rider, I love the idea of all those flames and stuff. And then, you know, then there's like the icons that you want to work on, like Superman, of course. I got to work on Batman. I had a run on Detective, so I checked that off my bucket list. But yeah, Superman, Green Lantern, yeah, those two definitely. And Wonder Woman, yeah, it's a long list.
I mean, I'm definitely not asking you to name names, but do you have people in mind that you would want to work on those with?
Oh, man. I have... Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do.
I don't want to use this to put anybody on the spot.
Yeah, I'm not going to name names. I got to say, Mike Hawthorne right now is doing some really good stuff on Daredevil, and I kind of wish I was coloring. I'm jealous.
And how is it different working on the interior colors and stuff versus doing a cover?
Covers, you know, covers take a lot more thought and understanding because, like, that's the first image that a reader's going to see on the stands. So I know a lot of times I like to check with editorial and see what the previous cover looked like or what the next cover is going to look like so I can make sure mine's a little different. And I spend a lot more time on covers. I probably spend as much time on covers as I would doing like two or three pages of interiors. It's gotta be striking. It's gotta be something that's easy to see on the stands and also something that fans will see and recognize immediately what the book is. So it's gotta work in conjunction with the tone of the book too.
So it probably makes you pretty excited too when you're online and you see people saying, oh, I want to get Chris's cover.
Oh, hell yeah. I love that. Listen, I've been doing this for a while. I've been doing this for 25 years about, right? And I'm still excited to get my comps in the mail. I'm still excited about seeing my name in print. I try not to read reviews, you know, because, you know, sometimes they hit you in the wrong spot. But usually when I'm tagged in a review, like on Twitter or social media, it's usually a good review and I'll check that out. So yeah, I kind of like that too. And I like getting feedback from fans on social media. That's pretty cool too. You know, the two fans I have.
Well, then it has to be at least three because Dan and Jake from Gatecrashers, which used to be DC Super Sons, plus me, so that's three.
Those guys are awesome.
Oh, I know, right? I definitely did not listen to your episode with them over the past few days again.
Oh, that's cool. All right.
How has it been now versus when you started dealing with the fans and them having this kind of level of contact with you?
In the beginning, it's a little disconcerting that fans have that kind of access. Maybe because it's something I didn't have growing up and reading comics. You know, I never had that kind of access to any of these other pros. You know, I, for the most part, unless I picked up an issue of Marvel Age magazine, I never even knew what a lot of the talent looked like. But I like being able to interact with fans who are just like fans who just really enjoy the stuff, you know? Like some of the side conversations about, you know, life and politics, some of that's okay. I like connecting with peers too in that respect. But I think for the most part, comic book fans are really, I mean, they're really cool. I really like comic book fans. I would say about 87% of comic book fans are awesome, right? I've had almost all positive interactions with them, especially when I see them at conventions later on. You know, they'll follow me on Twitter or Facebook or something. Then they'll see me at a convention, and you know, we just kind of talk like we've interacted before, which is kind of cool. I personally have been trying to figure out my social media presence a little bit, because you know, like everyone, you kind of fall into the traps of being on a little too often or getting a little too reactionary, and you know, so I've started to pull back a little bit. But I think the quality of the interactions I've been getting lately are better.
Yeah, it's a really weird dynamic. I'm a little younger than you, so like I grew up with the internet was essentially there by the time I was old enough to really do anything with it.
Right.
But you know, it was new for everybody, so we were all trying to figure it out together. And then now you've got kids, and it's just the internet is there. There's nothing weird about seeing your favorite author, your favorite artist at all, and being able to talk directly to them.
Yeah, it's ubiquitous. And it's, you know, it took a lot of getting used to, because I didn't have it. I never counted on something like that. You know, and when I dove in, I don't know, like 10 years ago or whatever it was all new, and like the only thing I had to make sure I didn't do was be an asshole, you know, publicly. But it's, I don't know, I guess when you figure out how to navigate it and you curate your social media so it's all like positive people, and I don't know, everyone just seems to have a good time. I mean, now, as far as my feeds are concerned, they do.
Yeah, keeping it full of positive people and not all those other people definitely seems to be the key.
Yeah, yeah. I just to maintain my own sanity and, you know, be able to work in peace and have those little interactions to be my distraction. That's like my rest period. I'll do something, you know, for work. I'll do a page, and I'll jump on Twitter real quick. I'll see what's new with everybody and what they're talking about. And I'll jump back over to work.
Yeah, I know from my side of things, I keep a list. It's really just more of a mental list of who the horrible people are, just so when I see that something happens, I can be aware of what they've done and add them to the list of people that will never come on the show.
Right.
Which does actually exist. There's 5 people on it right now.
Okay. I'm surprised it's only 5.
Honestly, me too. Yeah. But I'm also kind of limiting it to people that actually have a chance of being on.
Okay. Makes sense. You know, social media is—it's just something you have to curate. You have to actively curate, and I've learned that. I think everyone's learned that at this point.
Yeah, and then the kids get to learn it all over again every day.
Yeah.
I mean, how happy are you that you didn't grow up with the possibility that people were going to see what stupid 12-year-old Chris was saying?
Oh my God. You know, to have that kind of record go all the way back like that seems horrifying to me. I'd hate that. I mean, I was a much different person in my teens and even my 20s than I am now.
I mean, nobody's going to be able to have any kind of public office, do anything in the public light anymore in a few years, because everybody's going to be able to dig up something horrible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And everyone's taking screen caps and, you know, just waiting for someone to step out of line. Yeah. I know.
What are we going to do? Dogs and cats for president. It's the only way.
Yeah.
So while you're working, is it just you super focused on your work, or do you have any kind of distractions or anything going?
I have a bunch of news and political podcasts that I listen to. When I run through those every day, I'll switch over to music, or I'll put on a movie that I've seen a few times that I don't have to pay like really close attention to. Usually like one of the Marvel movies or something like that, you know, an action flick. And every once in a while with those movies running, I'll look up and I'll see something interesting that I can use in my work. So that works too. But yeah, I try to just have that stuff be the distraction. I mean, lately, you know, with the world burning and everything, I jump in and out of social media sometimes between pages or backgrounds and stuff. And that's why I had to try to, you know, reconfigure my social media habits. But those are probably the only deliberate distractions that I allow is my podcasts, my music, and then maybe a couple of movies.
And I'm hoping this question really doesn't date the episode, but how tempted were you to run out and buy GameStop stock?
Oh my God. I gotta say, because I have a great wife, very early on in our marriage, we decided to get into the stock market, right? This was late 90s, maybe early 2000s. So we bought Apple at like 17 bucks, 17 and change.
Oh, yeah. Man.
When I see this stuff happening with GameStop, I mean, if I were a day trader, I probably would have been more attentive to things like that. And I would have jumped on it, you know, when the getting was good. I wish I had, you know, paid a little more attention to stuff like that. But in hindsight, we did get in on some other things very early on in the game, and we doing pretty well with that stuff. So I can't cry spilled milk or anything like that. I can't be too sour. But that GameStop, man, that is something.
That's insane. And I've seen it get so many people into investing, and I hope that they don't have a really expensive lesson to learn.
Both of my daughters they've been asking us questions now about investing because of the GameStop thing. Not because we invested in Apple in the 90s, but because of the GameStop thing. Now they're asking. And I told them, don't get into GameStop now, because it's, you know, it's crazy. I wouldn't touch it yet. I wouldn't touch it ever. But I gave them some other things to look at, you know, that are more long-term things. But yeah, that GameStop, man.
What have been some of the, I guess, few, if you can't pick just one, but some of the few favorite projects that you've done?
Definitely The Question from last year, or we ended that last year. It kind of straddled 2019 and 2020. So The Question, my latest run on Deadpool and Batman Beyond. And then there was a book I did like around, what was it, 2010 or 2009 maybe, that was called Electric Ant. And it was the first book I got to kind of play around with a very different style. It flew under the radar. Nobody bought it. It was written by David Mack, drawn by Pascal Alixe, and it was based on a Philip K. Dick story. So, you know, very Blade Runner. They gave me a lot of room to play with it, and this was right after, I think, Richard had done Origins with Andy Kubert, or maybe 1602. Was it 1602, 1402? I forget. But yeah, so they were experimenting with more projects, more prestige projects, shot from pencils. This is a Marvel book, right? And the editor, Charlie Becker, he just kind of sent me a couple of pages and said, hey, can you do something with this and let's see what you do. And, you know, I sent it back and he jumped all over it and just kind of let me do what I wanted to do on it. And I took an approach that looked more like oil painting, which was nice for me because it was the first thing I'd done that wasn't like hardcore superheroes and had to look like, you know, superhero comics or have that kind of finished, polished look to it. So this one looked a little rougher in some respects, and probably a little more artsy, which, you know, could probably turn some people off. but I was really into it. I loved it. They put out a really nice hardcover that I may have a copy of. But yeah, like I said, no one bought it, but it looked nice. I thought it looked nice.
I mean, I just went and looked it up right now because I conveniently had a page open where I could do that kind of thing because I figured it would happen. And I mean, holy crap, this thing looks interesting. I mean, I'm judging books by their cover, but right. I mean, I don't care at this point. I'm going to have to go find this one.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun to work on. And they gave me a long time to do it, too, which was nice.
What kind of things are you reading right now?
I just finished reading... Oh, what the hell was this book by Mike Hawthorne? Happiness Will Follow. I just finished that, and I just finished reading the Sergio Topi books, the collected Sergio Topi, which I have right back here. There's 4 books out now. There's a 5th one coming out, I think, later this month or next month. So it's The Enchanted World, North Africa, South Africa, and The Cradle of Life. Monthly comics, not so much right now, but more collections and some harder to find stuff I've kind of been into.
And then I see an Xbox 360 controller back there.
Oh, yeah.
So what have you been playing?
Squadrons. Oh, that's an Xbox One back there, actually.
What?
I've been playing Star Wars Squadrons. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, I'll play for a little while and then I'll get caught up in work. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'll go back to the game and I'll completely forget the controls. So I got to start back on like the tutorials. But yeah, I got the Game Pass and every once in a while I'll just fire it up and sit and veg for a little while.
So I'm assuming I'm going to get you on for a regular episode later then.
Yeah, probably.
How do you keep yourself from putting too much of the influences that you have with the reading stuff and the playing stuff into your work?
I kind of like my influences, so I'm okay with having it bleed into the work. Like I'm good with you know, like I have a copy of Bill Sienkiewicz's Voodoo Child on my desk at all times. Sergio Topi books back there. I love. I'm looking for more of that kind of thing to incorporate. So, yeah, I'm okay with it. If I wear it on my sleeve, that's fine. You know, I'll even look at some more contemporary guys and check out what they're doing. And you know, if I use some of that stuff, you know, I don't apologize. I'm a big fan.
I mean, I just assumed you have a Demon Bear cover poster straight in front of you where you can see it and on the ceiling.
I'm looking right now at a Kent Williams Punisher poster that's hanging on my door. And there's a Mike Mignola print and a Drew Struzan drawing and all kinds of artwork on my other side here. And yeah, I look at all this stuff all the time. And I just found a couple of posters in a closet that have just been sitting there. There's a Frank Miller Daredevil poster and an Arthur Adams X-Men poster. So yeah, like all that stuff around me, all this stuff influences me. I love it.
So what do you think has been the biggest benefit to you working on comics?
Just the whole freelance structure in general, I think. I like, number one, I like the evolution of the art form. It keeps me on my toes, and I try to stay as competitive as I can. So I feel like I'm always pushing myself and trying to reinvent some of the things I do, right? I think that keeps it fresh. I think it keeps the job interesting for me for the most part. And I think it keeps my work interesting to editors and fans, I hope, if I'm doing it right. As far as the freelance structure, I like being home. I like not missing the kids' stuff. I mean, you know, I've got one left here out of my 3. But I like not ever having missed a soccer game or a volleyball game or a marching band competition. Or you know, a concert or, you know, some kind of performance. I love seeing my kids grow up. I love having them around. You know, I'm one of those parents that actually enjoys their kids, thank God, because, you know, I know that it can be tough sometimes. But I genuinely like spending time with my kids. And, you know, we all get along. So being able to just be here and chill with them and be able to relate to them and not miss anything it's probably the best part.
Yeah, I'm not jealous of the freelance schedule at all.
The only thing that could slow down my commute is my dog laying in the hallway.
Has your dog appeared in any of the comics yet?
I've got two who have not appeared. I did have my old Jack Russell Terrier did appear in an issue of Captain Marvel, I think. And my daughter has appeared in Captain Marvel also. This was way back in like 2001. Yeah, like I had dropped like one of her modeling photos in the background, and yeah, it was, you know, I did stuff like that every once in a while.
So how are you going to sneak these two dogs in?
I don't know, but I have to. I'm going to have to. And it'll probably be in well, no, I'm not going to say. but I feel like it's going to come soon, because I take a lot of pictures of my dogs.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to buy everything you ever make now so that I can find your dog in a comic.
That is not bad.
I mean,
I'll take that.
Whatever gets me to buy everything, right?
Sure, yeah. I make royalties, yeah.
So if somebody is a fan of your work, which I'm assuming everybody is because they have no reason not to be, what are the best ways to support you and make sure that you get to do more of it?
Oh, man. Shout outs on social media are always good, because I'll retweet those. You know, buy anything that I work on. Collections are always good. I mean, I personally like collections. I've got all kinds of trades on the three bookcases I'm looking at right now. So, but yeah, you know, shout outs on social media. I let my editors know that you like what I'm doing. Write in emails, I think are still looked at, you know, fan mail, all that stuff's good.
We can make
any
that happen.
Any kind of love helps. Sure.
I know. Thanks. I always try, when I do the comic reviews, I try to make sure that I credit everybody who worked on it, at least on the creative team.
That helps. Thank you. Yeah. That's always good.
I don't want to leave anybody out. You guys put in a lot of hard work on things that I can only dream about pulling off. And you've given me a free copy of things in most cases.
Oh, awesome.
The least I can do is say, hey, these are the people who worked on it.
There are a lot of us who make a lot of sacrifices for the schedule. So yeah, it's definitely appreciated.
And if I know somebody who wants to get into working on comics, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah. Number one, practice your craft, because that's important. If you're an artist, if you're interested in penciling, inking, or coloring, keep a sketchbook. You know, you don't have to show it to anybody. Just draw for yourself. Draw as often as possible. I mean, everyone's heard that advice all the time. If you're trying to get in as a writer, write as often as possible. Write everything. You know, whatever it is. Write fan fiction. Write, you know, put together pitches. Put together spec scripts. Hook up with other artists, you know, if you can. Meet them at conventions, say hi. There's a lot you can do as far as that's concerned. But ultimately, practice your craft. You know, seek out... There are classes that you can seek out. There are YouTube tutorials you can seek out for any kind of visual arts craft. You know, I teach a class on coloring. The company I teach for, Comics Experience, they have art and writing classes that cover all the everything that you would ever need to know to put together comics. Writing, penciling, inking, coloring, lettering, the whole shebang. There's a lot of different resources that are available now that were not available when I was coming up or when I was a kid trying to figure all this stuff out. I had to piece together information as best I could, write letters to people, try to talk to editors at conventions, and which is still a good thing to do. The resources available now are pretty easy to come by. And it's a lot easier to access talent and pick their brains for stuff. I'm on social media. I'm pretty easy to find. Everything is Soto Color for me. So if you can type that into a search, you'll find my social media, I'm sure. If you have any questions, if anyone had any questions about anything, I answer everything. I'm an idiot. So.
I mean, somebody has to answer, right?
Yeah. And I answer everything. That's what I mean by being an idiot. I should really probably not answer everything. But yeah, I do. I answer everything.
I'm going to think of some really dumb questions for you now.
And I'll answer them.
We'll see how long we can make this go. So the classes you teach, are they in person, or at least before all of this craziness, were they just in person, or were you offering online as well?
It's a virtual class, so it's done in real time, online. It's always been online. I've been teaching since, I think, for about 10 years now. I think this is my 10th year. We've sold out every time, knock on wood. I've been fortunate. They're live online. They're recorded for students. They get homework assignments. I'm in the middle of teaching a course this week. It goes till March 1st. So we're at the halfway point right now. You get real world assignments. What I do is I break down the process into its basic elements. And we talk about color theory and how to incorporate values and master color usage and the tools and technique and all that wonderful stuff. And hopefully I pack enough in that the students feel like they get enough out of it. And I've had no complaints so far.
I'd think that if you were missing something, you would have had complaints, or at least not selling out every time.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've had some all-star students, I would say. Like Dave Finch has taken the class. Dave Finch, Jamal Eigel, Rochelle Rosenberg, Peter Krause, Heather Antos, just a bunch of people who already work in comics. Amy Chu, Rich Dueck. They've all taken the class, if not to learn the craft and how to do it, then at least to learn about the craft and how to interact with their own talent better. So I've had a good time teaching it too.
What's the best way to, I feel weird asking this because I answer it for people all the time, but what is the best way to reach out to some talent like that and try to get an answer to your question or get some kind of project going if you think you're at that kind of level?
I've found that people have pretty good success at conventions. When we get back to that, going up and down Artist Alley is always helpful. Like if you're a writer trying to put together, a creator-owned book or something, I know writers who've gone up and down Artist Alley and just taking a look at some of the people there, either showing portfolios or people at tables, and just strike up a conversation. Most comics folks are pretty friendly and easygoing, and they'll talk for as long as you want to talk. As long as you stand to the side and let traffic come through. I would say conventions, and if you're friends with a creator online and you have that kind of interaction where you can, pop in a private message or something, or direct message, that works too. I know it's tough for writers to break in because it's such a visual medium. An editor can usually figure out if an artist is ready for professional work just by looking at it. But writers are, it's more difficult for them because you have to convince an editor to sit down and read your stuff. And that's kind of the hurdle. And I think that's why a lot of editors and publishers, they'll say, you know, if you're a writer who wants to get work, your best bet is to go make a comic and show that to people. But, you know, it's pretty easy for someone to say, go make a comic. But actually making the comic is, that's a whole other undertaking. Because you have to find everyone else to help you do that thing.
Yeah, because I've definitely got the idea in my head, but I can't make the art come out. So I'm going to have to find somebody for that.
Right, right.
And then I'm going to have to pay them because I'm not an asshole.
Good deal.
You got to pay your artists. And honestly, the artist selling the book. You know, if I wanted to write like a book and not worry about the art, I'd just go write a book.
Right, right. Well, yeah, in terms of comics, the art does have a huge hand in selling the book. The art will draw them in and the story will keep them there, right? And more to the point, like, I know writers who have day jobs and then they go home and they write, or they write at their day jobs on their breaks or whatever, right? An artist, it takes so long to produce that work. An artist can't always have a day job and then go home and then be an artist full time and expect to function the next day. So there's a time commitment in there that really can't be matched, right? So I know writers who will work on 3 or 4 different books, but an artist can only do 1 book a month. You know, just it's the weight of the workload. You know, so yeah, everyone should pay their artists, definitely.
I've heard multiple people telling me that when they've gotten things into an anthology or something, as a writer, it's just been, screw it, artists take all the money.
Well, I've heard that too. Usually, like I said, the writer can sometimes have another source of income, and an artist has to spend all their time making the art.
Well, Chris, it's been great talking to you about all of this. If people want to hear more from you, where else can they find you around the internet?
They can find me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, Twitch, YouTube. I have a Facebook page, all Soto Color. If you search that, you can find me.
And as always, we will have links to those down in the show notes, because clicking links is so much easier than trying to spell things, even when they're simple words like Soto Color.
Absolutely.
Got to make it easy on the phone, people.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Click links and copy paste.
We'll also have some links down there for some of Chris's work. Some things that he mentioned here and some other things that I enjoyed that I think you should just go check out anyway.
Awesome. Thanks.
And as always, if you want to hear more from me, you can head on over to Twitter at PlayComicsCast. Where you can just kind of interact with me over there. It's really fun. I try to have fun now that crazy political season is over. Yeah, let's just leave it there. If you want to support the show, head on over to the Patreon page. I'm working on maybe getting it somewhere else as well, because Patreon is being a, how do I keep this PG-13, a giant booger face. I think that is the proper way to say it. But you're going to get the same content no matter where it is, you know, so no worries there. If you like Patreon, that's fine. But I want to give people the option because, you know, booger faceness. If you want to hear some other wonderfully geeky shows, head on over to getagegeek.com, where you can hear some other wonderfully, amazingly geeky shows. And I said a new adjective, so I deserve a dollar. Or at least a cookie. If you like the music that I'm really talking on top of right now, head on over to soundcloud.com/best-day to check out Best Day's music. But most of all, just grab a game, grab a stack of comics, preferably ones that are colored by Chris Sotomayor, because that's just a guarantee that they're going to be fun, and find yourself a new favorite character. There we go. Finally got the burp out.
Nice.
Don't you love those ones that are sitting right there in your throat? You can feel them.
You're just trying to push it out, yeah. Okay.
And one question that I completely forgot, I might use this as the outtake, we'll see. What is better, Mexican or Spanish chorizo?
Oh man, that is tough. I gotta say, I've probably enjoyed Spanish chorizo a little bit more, just because, I mean, you have to have a really good Mexican chorizo, like an authentic one, because chorizo can really screw that up if it's too, like, Tex-Mexy or something like that. If it's made for the American market, it can fall a little flat.
Oh yeah, that's all garbage anyway. I want the real stuff.
Yeah, the real stuff is that's got to be where it's at. So if it's authentic, then I'll give the edge to Mexican, just because the flavor, I think, is a little more vibrant, just by a hair.
I mean, you're not going to go wrong either way.
No, you're really not. It's really hard to go wrong with chorizo.